From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how is outside money impacting judicial elections in places like Wisconsin? Then quantifying the ripple effect of shopping local.
Shifting 10% more in local restaurants and retailers will leave $311 million more dollars in our community.
Later, UWM Prof. Liam Callanan is a celebrity judge on a Chinese game show watched by 300 million people. And Pulitzer winner Paul Harding returns with a simple, difficult subject in his latest novel.
If the basic premise of the novel is a parent losing his only child, you take one false step in any direction and you have maudlin, melodramatic, sentimental hogwash.
Lake Effect is next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Big money has had a hold on politics for a while, but a recent report points to its now significant influence on judicial elections. The report by the nonpartisan group Justice at Stake calculates $56.4 million spent on state Supreme Court elections in 2011 and 2012. $33.7 million was spent on TV ads alone in places including Wisconsin, whose ads landed it on the report's Hall of Shame. Today in Milwaukee, a legal organization will hear from a former Mississippi Supreme Court justice who experienced the influence of outside money firsthand. Oliver Diaz will speak at the winter meeting of the Wisconsin Association for Justice this afternoon. He's with us now in the studio. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
What difference does money make? Why should we care about the money being spent on judicial elections and more specifically, where it comes from?
Well, it's a big problem. I may be able to give you an example to start off with. In Mississippi and Wisconsin, very similar actually, we elect our judges. For years in the United States, judges have been out of the political realm, actually. Even though we elected them, it was not the type elections that you see, the partisan type elections that you normally see in other races. In 1990 in Mississippi, the average winning Supreme Court justice spent $25,000 to get elected. In 2000, the year 2000, 10 years later when I first ran, that amount was up to $1 million. During the time period of the 1990s, you see how exponentially the amount of money judicial campaigns started absorbing. And it sort of changed the face of the judiciary. When you get a politicized judiciary, it sort of undermines what we were doing in this country. We want fair and honest judges. We don't want political partisans.
Why hasn't this been an issue for longer? As you say, judicial elections are nothing new. Campaign spending is nothing new. So what happened in the 1990s to lead to this?
It basically goes back to the tort reform movement. And for the folks who aren't familiar with tort reform, it's issues that were raised in the legislature. Business interests wanted to come in and change laws, sort of maybe put caps on damages. They talked about frivolous lawsuits and things like that. Well, what was happening was they began to pass these bills through the legislature doing things that they called tort reform. The problem with that is the courts oversee lawsuits. I mean, we have a right to a jury trial in the United States, and some of these laws were taking away your jury rights. I mean, why should the legislature set a cap or a limit on how much you could recover when a jury is awarding this certain amount? So what would happen was these laws were being tested in the courts, and judges were finding that these laws may be unconstitutional. So the business interests that were supporting these laws realized that they needed judges on the courts that would uphold the legislation that they were actually passing through the legislature and the executive branch.
Well, and your own experience illustrates this issue, right? I mean, this was the issue that got a lot of attention paid to your campaign.
Oh, exactly. And it's not just happening in Mississippi. It's not just happening in Wisconsin. The forces that are behind this, and you see these massive amounts of money basically coming out of Washington, D.C., and it's basically these conservative business groups that are dumping lots of money, and they do it independently, actually, not even through the campaign. They're buying 30-second television ads and trying to influence the elections that way.
Do you see this issue as any different than any other form of campaign finance reform?
Well, that's the problem, is when you get into the judiciary. You know, we expect partisan elections for governor or for the executive branch, for president, or for the legislature. And the candidates take a position and they say that I'm for this and, you know, elect me because I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal or whatever it is. We expect that. But judges are not supposed to be partisans, political partisans. Everybody wants a fair and honest judge. We don't want to judge one side or the other. Judges are supposed to be governed by the rule of law, by the facts of the case, by the evidence in each case, and not by a political philosophy. When the courts are no longer fair and impartial, but rather partisan participants, then you get a whole different face for the judiciary at that point.
Well, and so is there any way to chart the practical implications of the spending? I mean, is there any way to say that because this one group put this sum of money into this race, a decision turned out a certain way? Because I would think justices would make the point that they are not for sale.
Well, you know, that would be interesting to do a study to see if campaign contributions, if you give certain money, will a case come out a certain way? Most judges will recuse themselves if they get direct money, but a lot of these interest groups do not give money to judges, so they're not reported. But it goes much deeper than that, whether or not it actually influences the decision. When you get the perception, when people have a perception that justice can be bought and sold, it undermines the whole system of our courts, our whole system of impartial justice.
Why isn't this a freedom of speech issue? Why shouldn't people or organizations be allowed to spend whatever they want to say what they want about who they want?
Well, that's certainly the law. And the United States Supreme Court has held many times that the amount of money somebody spends is a form of free speech, and you're entitled to do that. I'm not arguing that you shouldn't do that. I just want people to be aware that judges are a bit different than partisan offices, and we have to treat it that way. Judges are governed by ethics. We're governed by the state ethics bar. We're not supposed to take a stand on issues or say, you know, I'm going to convict every criminal that comes before me. We don't want a judge like that. We want a judge who's going to weigh the facts and listen to the evidence.
Do you have any sense for whether the additional money that is being spent – I mean, you talked about back before this happened in 1990 in Mississippi, the average cost of a election for Supreme Court justice was $25,000. It is exponentially higher than that now. With the additional money and attention being paid to these elections, does it increase voter participation? Is there a positive spin that more attention to these races is a good thing?
Well, actually, I think it has the opposite effects. Many studies have shown that the more negative a campaign is, it sort of suppresses voter turnout. People are sort of disgusted by the whole thing. You know, you've seen it in races for governor, for president. Last year we saw it with Mitt Romney and President Obama. They have these terrible ads that come on and say really mean things about one or the other. The difference in judicial elections is that these ads tend to define the judges. With Mitt Romney or President Obama, you get these negative ads, but it's not the only information you have. You know these guys. President Obama's been in office for 4 years. Mitt Romney's been running for president since he was 4 years old. you get a feel. These ads, the 30-second negative ads, don't define them. But with a judicial candidate, this may be the only information that the voter gets about a judge is one of these really horrible 30-second ads, and it tends to actually define the judicial candidate. You know, judges are sort of egotistical. We like to think that people know who we are. You know, we walk into the courtroom and lawyers bow and say, Your Honor, and so on and so forth. The truth is not many people know judges. You get these crazy polls every once in a while where people will realize that, you know, more people can name the Three Stooges than three members of the Supreme Court. And when you have a low name ID and these horrible ads, you can actually define a person, and that's why it's a little bit different in these judicial elections.
What about people who would say that the election of judges in the first place is a problem?
Yeah, actually, that's been argued. The Federalist Papers, when the country was formed, when we wrote the Constitution, they debated the role, how judges should be selected. It's an age-old question. There's no easy answer to that, and I think each state's going to have to decide on its own. But the way these elections have turned recently, and the ability to dump large amounts of money and actually purchase a seat on a court, you're buying a seat on the bench. It's just really unseemly.
Well, and so then in the wake of Citizens United, what do you see as the solution or solutions to this?
Well, there are lots of different solutions. The main solution is education. And the voters have to be informed independently of these 30-second ads. You know, that's an idealistic approach. It's very difficult for voters to inform themselves and get ideas of who the candidates are, especially with judges when you're not allowed to take a position on certain issues. All you can say, you know, I've been a lawyer for 40 years. Well, I've been a lawyer for 45 years. Therefore, I'm better. But there you have to educate yourself. You know, there are also different options, retention elections. There are public funding of elections. There are lots of different solutions and you know, what I want to do is get the debate started, let people think about what's going on, because most people don't realize right now that the seats on the Supreme Court or sometimes the lower courts are actually being purchased by special interest groups.
Well, and so let me ask you this. Maybe it's a strange question, but let's say you are the average voter and you're trying to distance yourself from the campaign ads that paint potential would-be judges in a certain light. What are the kinds of things that you would look for in deciding who to vote for in a Supreme Court or even a lower court race?
Well, you know, there are lots of independent voter guides. A lot of independent groups put out report cards on judges. The Bar Association is always a great resource. They know the lawyers who are running. If all else fails, ask your local attorney. I mean, we as a Bar Association, lawyers and judges have to take this into our own hands. We know the candidates who are running better than anybody else. We have to get out. I mean, lawyers should be going out to their local Rotary clubs or chambers of commerce and educating average people about who these are that are running for these jobs. But it all goes back into more information, and the more information a voter can get, the better decision they can make.
But it is a thorny issue when you consider that judicial candidates can't say that, you know, I would rule in a certain way about a certain issue.
Exactly, and that makes my point as to why judicial elections are different from legislative elections and executive branch elections. Judges can't come out and say, I'm going to do such and such on every case that comes before me. We don't want judges who do that, and that's why judicial elections have to be different than other elections.
Oliver Dias, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here today.
Oliver Dias served as a justice on the Mississippi State Supreme Court. He's now a lawyer in private practice. And his story of being targeted by outside money was told in both a documentary and a John Grisham novel. He'll speak on the subject this afternoon in Milwaukee at the winter meeting of the Wisconsin Association for Justice. We'll take a quick break now and then learn about the influence of local money spent locally. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The day following last week's Black Friday was known as Shop Local Saturday, but a Milwaukee area organization is trying to make shopping local a more regular part of everyone's buying habits. The coalition Local First Milwaukee is trying to convince people to spend one-tenth of their buying dollars at locally owned and operated businesses. And the group points to research showing a dramatic ripple effect on the community at large from that modest investment. Nancy Quinn is the managing director for Local First Milwaukee, and she's with us in the studio now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
I'm happy to be here.
outline this for us. What do you point to as the compelling reasons for buying more anyway from independent local businesses?
Well, I think independent local businesses are what makes our community unique. And so when you look and you're going to shop somewhere, the independent local businesses are the ones that are, you know, caretakers of our community. So they know what is interesting to the people that live in Milwaukee. They sell those items, but they also provide services that are very Milwaukee-oriented. That's one of the reasons. The locally independent businesses, you're not going to find them in other cities. It is Milwaukee. But also, I think one of the reasons really to do it is these are your neighbors. The owners of these businesses are your neighbors. They pay their taxes here. They employ local people who then spend money locally. So it's a kind of a ripple effect that really does make a difference. It allows for greater arts. It allows for more, just a more interesting place to work and live.
Let me ask you the question that I imagine that the skeptics might say. You know, it's great that there are locally owned businesses, but they might say, you know, a smaller local store might employ 6 or 8 or 10 people, but that Home Depot is employing 65. Aren't I helping more of my neighbors by buying my snowblower there?
You may think so, but collectively, small businesses are the biggest employer in the country. Add it all together, smaller businesses employ more people. And then when you shop at these local businesses, it's amazing when I listen to the stories of some of our businesses, Purple Door Ice Cream, Indulgence Chocolatiers, Anodyne Coffee, just all come to mind. They're all on that sort of strip or going to be on 2nd Street. As they grow, they create more jobs. And they add full-time jobs. They add good-paying jobs. They add jobs that have great meaning to the people that work there. So I think actually shifting your shopping creates more jobs.
Well, and so as nice as it would be to imagine that someone might shift all of his or her buying to right. independent local businesses, you are hoping people will just do 10%. Why is 10% the key number?
For a couple of reasons. First of all, it's not realistic to shift all of your shopping on a day-to-day basis, and we're not expecting that. We're really pro-local. And what we want people to do is to sit and think about where they do their purchasing and just see, is there a local option? If there's a local option, make that shift, and you might find out that you're getting better service, that you're getting better products, that you're enjoying the experience more, and you're going to stick with it. 10% is a manageable amount. Start where you are today. Take a look at these purchases and then make that shift. And when you do, you can add 10% more the next year. But we recognize that there are certain services and products that just aren't available locally. That's the fact, or with a local business. So starting at 10%, the other thing is that we had a study done for us by Civic Economics, who has done these types of studies in different cities all over the country. And in 2012, they did one in Milwaukee. And what that study showed is that a 10% shift by Milwaukeeans from where they are today to shifting 10% more in local restaurants and retailers will leave $311 million more dollars in our community just by making that shift. Our businesses are going to expand.
This is if everybody does this.
If everybody does it, right. And it is a year-round shift, and, you know, there's a lot to add up to that. But some people are going to do more. And it's a pretty amazing number when you look at $311 million. That's a lot of money.
You mentioned restaurants. So this includes the idea that instead of maybe going to that chain restaurant in the strip mall, you might just go to a local independent restaurant.
And actually, restaurants are pretty interesting because as you recognize some of the restaurants around here, you know, many of our restaurants, Milwaukee's restaurant culture has really grown up in the last couple of years, and many of them really do support local producers. So when you're thinking about that multiplier effect again, it's local farmers, it's local artisan food makers. So as I mentioned Purple Door Ice Cream before, when you eat at a local restaurant, you're probably supporting a local food artisan or farmer as well. So it's that sort of ripple effect. And restaurants, you know, again, you really want, if you want a unique Milwaukee experience, patronize our local restaurants. It's really, it's fabulous. Why go somewhere that you can go in any other city?
It is not necessarily the easiest of economies either to run a business or always to shop at a business. What about the other issue that people often raise, and that is cost? You know, I could buy my Tylenol from the local little store in the downtown part of my town, but it might cost a dollar more than it costs me to get it at Target.
Again, I think you do have to make your choices, and you might choose that there are certain products that you're going to get the same exact product at someplace else, and you're going to choose to get that discounted product. That is a consumer choice. However, in the long run, if you're interested in having a unique community with unique businesses, if you're able to do it, the extra money is worth it. And it's worth it because it is going to create a very Milwaukee place to live. And so, again, we're not asking for a 100% shift. We're asking you to really think and say, hey, is it possible? You know, I was a former bookseller. I, you know, talk about books. That's a perfect example of something that is available elsewhere. But the types of service that you get at a store where you can go and you can find books that you just wouldn't happen upon, that kind of service needs to be rewarded with a local purchase, I think. And local bookstores offer a lot of culture and are often the backbone of a neighborhood. So, again, I would suggest that really thinking about, can I and should I be making this purchase locally if possible?
And in the midst of this campaign, do I understand there is an event that you have that's bringing some of these local options together?
We do. We have our Buy Local Gift Fair. It's taking place on Sunday, December 8th at Lakefront Brewery. And again, this year, appreciate Lakefront hosting us. That's a truly local institution with some great local beer. And we'll have 40 of our businesses. So 40 local retailers, again, food artisans, artists, and just all under one roof from 12 to 4 at Lakefront Brewery. And you can just get all of your local shopping there. I recommend that you go and make your little list and come. And it's, you know, 4 hours of great fun. We have a tall guy and a grill and simmer truck providing some food to help you, you know, make it through the afternoon. But it's a great time, and we get a lot of support from Milwaukee.
You've been at this local first, has been around for a few years doing this.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's going great. I think it's just really exciting because as the message gets out there, you know, I hear more and more from people. We hear it from our members that say people are coming to shop because we're local or because we're participating in this. You know, we're growing, and it's exciting. And I think part of it is we are part of a movement that's happening in other places as well. We are a member of an organization called Amoeba, which is about 150 of our peers across the country who are doing this in other places. And in fact, a study by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, they do this study every January after the holiday season, and they ask independent businesses around the country, how were your sales? And what they found in 2012 is that in cities that had organizations like ours that were supporting the shop local movement during the holidays, those communities saw, those independent businesses at those communities, saw an 8.6% increase in business versus 3.4% in cities that didn't have organizations like ours that are helping to get the message out. So, you know, we feel pretty good about that, and it's exciting.
At the same time, what keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up? There's always more, you know, and it is hard. It's, you know, you see some of these lovely, lovely businesses. You know, it's hard to be entrepreneurial. It's hard to, you know, so many of these people, we hear about it every month. Here's a new business that, you know, I was so passionate about being able to make this product or sell this item, and I love it so much, I'm quitting my day job to do it. And we see so many success stories, but they're not always success stories. And that's really hard to see when a business closes. Or, you know, if you believe that some business is important to you, then support them.
Does buying local at a time like this, at the holiday season, necessarily translate to buying local year-round for people?
Well, I hope it does. We are actually doing a pledge to shop local this holiday season, specifically because for many businesses, you know, more and more of their business, some people say 30%, it depends on the business, happens in these last 2 months. This is a place where we can bring consumers in and educate them about this message, and then hopefully they will carry it on. And, you know, head over to localfirstmilwaukee.com and take our pledge. Our pledge is, again, tied to that 10% that you and I talked about a little earlier. And we're asking people to shift 10% of their holiday shopping, more than they've done in the past, to local businesses. And then again, that they continue to do that year-round. We're, you know, next year we're going to be focusing on businesses supporting local businesses. Again, looking at, you know, I'm buying products and services for my business. Could I be doing that locally? And we're going to be focusing on local food, and we're going to be focusing on moving your money. So our idea is that there are different places where people come to local, and if we can bring them in, maybe it'll make a shift, a long-term shift.
Nancy Quinn, thanks so much, and best of luck.
Thank you, too.
Nancy Quinn is the managing director for Local First Milwaukee. You'll find a link to more about the organization, plus the group's local gift fair slated for tomorrow, from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. What have you done this year? Were you a celebrity judge on a Chinese game show? Unless you were Liam Callanan, the answer is probably not, but we will hear Liam's story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Reality TV shows have become a big deal in this country over the past 15 years or so, but if you think the U.S. has the market cornered, think again. UW-Milwaukee English professor Liam Callanan found himself playing a role in a reality game show in China this year, and the experience was, well, he will describe it for us, as he did in an essay published this fall on the literary website Medium. Liam Callanan, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
And maybe I should say welcome back to the States, because you were in – it's been a while, but you were in China some time ago. Explain how this gig as a celebrity judge on a reality show came to be.
You know, this is something I do every summer, appear on celebrity reality shows in foreign countries, but actually it's not. This summer, it was a very exciting opportunity that came up when UWM, which has been working very hard to recruit students from China, had an opportunity to be part of this show that would expose the UWM brand and name to millions of people. In fact, I think over 330 million viewers of the show that I was on, which was to determine the best English-speaking child in China.
And 330 million viewers is, if I'm not mistaken, and I think you write this, more than watch the Super Bowl in this country.
Yes, more Chinese watch this show than Americans watch the Super Bowl, which was something when I got up there and introduced myself and introduced the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And told everyone that Milwaukee had great weather, because we have been told by our Chinese partners that a lot of people are concerned about the weather here. So there are at least 300 million people now who think that Milwaukee is a little bit like Milwaukee. That's assuming that I pronounced my Chinese correctly, which I'm not sure. I did not learn that much Chinese, but I did learn how to say Milwaukee has great weather. And then, of course, I didn't have to learn too much more than that, because the show was about finding the best English speaker. It was an amazing experience. And it was something that was really hard to capture on the page. But in this piece that I wrote for Medium, I just tried to somehow capture all the kind of a 360 vision of what I was involved in, in part because the people around me the whole time kept saying, like, you're a writer. You must just be blown away by this experience. It must be really so wonderful to have the opportunity to write about it. And the more that I was there, the more it kind of went beyond what I even thought I could capture with words.
And there is, to be sure, a great deal of absurdity that surrounds this entire experience.
An immense deal of absurdity. From start to finish, when I landed at the airport and they were holding up a sign that said, "Welcome celebrity guest judge Liam Callanan," that was funny enough. But then the sign next to that said, "Welcome celebrity guest judge Paul Newman." And I thought, oh, dear, because for one thing, Newman was spelled wrong and he's also no longer with us. So I thought this show is about to get really strange. And it did. And Paul turned out to be a perfectly nice and actually living person who showed up from Queens, New York. But when we got there, I was expecting something very rinky-dink with card tables and giant lollipop microphones. This was higher tech than anything I've seen on American TV, and it was located in a bright orange castle that was actually the home of the Agriculture and Military Channel, a 24/7 channel.
And you included that detail. I almost thought you had been making that up.
No, there are 12 state-run channels in China, and the show that I was on was going to be air on another network, the Education Channel. Channel 1 is for news, kind of like BBC 1. And actually, the Washington correspondent of Channel 1, Chinese State Television, she won this contest previously. So, no, we were in the Agriculture and Military Channel, and there was a giant photo of the agriculture newscasting team as we came in. I didn't see anything about the military team. And the studio itself looked beautiful from the outside, but like much of China, also seemed to be a work in progress with some construction debris, but we just kind of stepped around that and then scooted inside, and then the magic started.
Well, and so talk about your role. You were a celebrity judge, but you make a distinction in this piece that you're a celebrity judge, but they're also a panel of real judges.
Yes, and that was definitely a big surprise for me. When I got there, I thought they had said it was going to be a four-judge panel with three Chinese celebrities and then an American. And so I thought, well, here I go. And I got my swiveling practicing in. You know, I sat at home and swiveled as much as I could in my chair. But then when I got there, it turned out the three Chinese celebrities were going to sit in the middle of the stage, and then almost a dozen of us foreign celebrities kind of sat in this foreign judge bullpen off to the left. And the Chinese celebrities, who included a comedian who had grown up or lived in Seattle for quite some time, an anchor from the Education Channel, and then this really interesting woman who was a young woman out of Columbia University in New York City, and I was told by my translator that she was a diver. And I thought I asked her, like Jacques Cousteau, and there was kind of a pause, and then they said yes. And so for much of the show, I thought that she was kind of an aquanaut. And then I learned later on that, no, she actually had been a participant on another reality show, which was Celebrity Splash China, which were people who jump off of platform diving.
So like what might be called So You Think You Can Dive.
Exactly. So You Think You Can Dive. So she was one of the other judges. And we could never really talk to the main Chinese celebrity judges, because although I didn't know any of them, they were so famous that they kind of had like a force field around them that kind of prevented you from going up and just saying like, hey, how did that dive go? And we were on completely separate like little tiers. But it was interesting. They obviously spoke Chinese, all of them, and English. And I speak very little Chinese other than Milwaukee has great weather and hello. But it was fascinating just to kind of see how they moved through it. And at first, you know, it really did seem like it was going to be just one funny moment after another. And there was a lot of fun. But it also hit home to me, not just about this show, but all these reality shows, that it's kind of a moving experience. We saw 40 kids, and they had beaten out, I think, 4 million other entrants, which meant they were like the 1% of 1% of 1%. So they were all fluent. I mean, every one of them was a winner, and certainly they all spoke English. I mean, some of them spoke English better than I do. But when they lost and they would start crying, it suddenly became very much less funny, especially for, you know, I'm a dad and I have people in the classroom, and that's just that was very awkward. And I know that it makes great television, but Lordy, that's one way to spend your summer.
Well, and it sounds like it is not that dissimilar, only with much different production values from, say, the National Spelling Bee in this country.
That's when people ask me to describe it, and I say, well, it looked like American Idol, but it kind of felt like the National Spelling Bee. And I remember a lot of people, especially our Chinese hosts over there, said, you all should have something like this in the United States. And I said, one, I don't know if we can come up with 4 million entrants for a Chinese language competition, let alone 40. But two, I just don't know if there's a television audience here where this is a firmly established show. It's more than a dozen years old. People have gone on from the show to host various channels. It launches careers in China. Once you've won this thing, you – and not just you, but your family and your teacher, because the teachers also came to the show. You're all quite large celebrities. And it was fascinating to think that something like this was possible there.
Well, and for China being such a global economic force, it really still speaks to what's at stake from learning English.
Absolutely. There were people, the amount of English that I heard spoken and just the way that English was honored throughout the country was amazing. And it was just everywhere I turned, we talked about English. In the cab ride from the airport, a graduate student from their foreign language university came to pick me up. And within 5 minutes of hopping in that cab, we were having this pretty deep conversation about Toni Morrison's novel Sula, which is not one that everyone reads. And she had this fascinating analysis of the characters as foils. And we talked about, you know, where they lived. And I thought, my goodness, this is not a conversation I have in many cabs in the United States, let alone China, let alone in just perfect English. One day I went for a run in a nearby campus, and I thought people were calling out to me as I ran by, but because they were speaking English. And then I slowed down and I realized actually they were kind of each standing next to a tree and they were practicing their monologues for what must have been an English language exam later on that day. So wherever you looked, there were people who were looking to learn English, celebrating English, looking to demonstrate your English. It was almost like linguistic mugging. People would come up to you and say, hello, it is a beautiful day here. You are handsome, you know, and so – and it was just fascinating to kind of want to react to that.
Well, and so if you were not on the actual three-judge panel, you were in this bullpen. What was your role?
Our role was to critique the contestants who didn't go on. I kind of deliver a verbal hug as they left, because the winners exited stage left and there were much fireworks. In fact, they played Katy Perry's Fairy Work. And then if they lost, they played Skylar Grey, Diddy Money's I'm Coming Home. I won't sing it, but it was very, you know, the screens would all go gray and the, kind of this acid rain would fall. And then they would come over to the foreign judges because the Chinese judges had just dissed them basically. And then they would come over to us. And if we liked them, we would hit a little light, and then we would say a couple things about them. And
this is the pillar between your legs?
Yes. There was a giant glowing pillar between my legs, which was topped with a really big yellow button. And I could not keep from hitting that button. I mean, I think there's just something about – there's a four-year-old boy in all of us. I mean, you see like a big button like that, you really want to smack it. And so I did. And also because I liked all the kids. And so I kind of set a record on the show as being – the person who hit the button for every single child. But as I pointed out to my fellow judges and actually the Chinese judges at one point, they all spoke perfect English. I wasn't sure why other people weren't hitting the button. And in some cases, they all had to do a talent, like they had to do a monologue and then they had to perform something, nunchucks or karate or guitar, or one kid did a comedy act, which really fell flat. But I still hit my button and I told them that I thought it was, you know, really interesting existential comedy, and they reminded me of Samuel Beckett. And which actually that rocked the Chinese judges back on their heels tonight. They said, whoa, we got to step up our game. And I was like, and how? Here we go. But he was great. The child was great. And so when they came over to our place, I would tell them, not only were you great, but you would be particularly great if you one day applied to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And the tricky thing was that some of them were too young. Most of the ones I saw were too young to come. So I couldn't really tell an 8-year-old, you know, we'll see you next year. Although, honestly, many of them had language skills that, you know, they would do really well in their classrooms. But I think we raised Wisconsin's profile over there.
Well, Liam Callinan, even if we do not have nearly as many people in the audience as a certain game show, we are glad you graced our airwaves. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me. I'll answer that call anytime.
Liam Callinan teaches English at UW-Milwaukee, is the author of two novels, and this summer was called on to serve as a celebrity judge on a reality game show in China to find that country's best young English speaker. You'll find a link to his essay about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Pulitzer winner Paul Harding is back with a novel on a tough subject, but it is a decidedly non-maudlin interview when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Writer Paul Harding gave himself a tough act to follow. His first novel, Tinkers, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. It took place in New England, a locale he returns to in his latest novel, Enon, and the book's protagonist is the grandson of the lead character in the first book. But while the stories are far different, the stories also share Harding's impeccable writing skill and his fearless taking on of a subject most of us would rather avoid, death. Harding, who was in Milwaukee this fall, tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North after spending 2 years immersed in the subject and in creating his latest book, it was nice to get out and talk about it in the real world.
The swings of the pendulum are long and sometimes, you know, but I spent so long out on the road for Tinkers, and then I spent so long sort of practically becoming agoraphobic at my home in north of Boston, just totally immersed every single day in the composition and revision and revision and revision and revision of Enon. And you just spend so much time just with yourself inside the work that then when it's published, it's a great relief to sort of go back out into the world and you sort of get revivified by just going out and talking with people. And it's such an interesting thing because part of it is, you know, it's, the work of art is solitary and it's just you and the blank page or the blinking cursor or whatever. But, you know, then, you know, a work of art is essentially a gesture of fellowship. You know, so you want to go out and talk with people about reading and writing and art.
Is it at all scary, though, when you spent that much time basically creating something, in this case, that's quite dark but yet also hopeful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yet, you know, are you at all afraid that people are going to reject it?
It's inevitable. I mean, there's always that worry because you do have to go for long periods of time without sort of getting feedback. I mean, my agent gives me feedback and my editor, but that's sort of that's kind of the editorial process. You just wonder when it goes out into the world. You know, of course, you're afraid of rejection, but you have to have faith in the idea that if you think it's all right, there's going to be other people who like it. One of the things I always tell my writing students is don't write your books for people who won't like them. You know, because you can get into that, like, oh, well, this kind of person won't like the book. So then the problem is you don't write the real story. You write in anticipation of antagonistic readers, which is just that you won't write a good book that way. You know, the people who like my writing like my writing. It's a strange, it's almost tautological. And then with Enon, yeah, it's I mean, when I first got the idea for it, I thought, oh, good, a spooky New England, you know, ghost story. And then I wrote the first page of it and realized, no, this is just an incredibly sad tragedy. It's just a tragedy. It almost makes Tinkers look like a sitcom, you know.
Almost,
you know. But then that just, as a writer, was just this book presenting its own particular challenges. To avoid sentimentality, to avoid melodrama, to avoid, I don't know, just any of the predictable possible pitfalls of writing about that subject matter.
How much can we give away here?
You can give away everything. Spoiler. I mean, I'm solely interested in writing about character. So to me, plot is a predicate of character. So that if you read the first paragraph of Enon, you know what the whole story is. In the same way that it's the same is true of Tinkers. Mm-hmm. For me as an author, that's just a way of making sure that I don't do any three-card Monty stuff with plot. It's like all the cards are on the table and now the story must be in the telling.
The story is a very simple one and a very sad one, which is that a man loses his only child in a terrible car accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rest of the book is about how he does and doesn't deal with it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And as you say, it's character. It's mm-hmm. about who this man is.
Yeah, it's his attempt to be – well, to be equal to is maybe not quite the right word, but to how to survive it, how to, in from his point of view, live up to the memory of his daughter. He really becomes unraveled and it only gets worse. But he has the constant awareness throughout the whole book that he's unraveling and that he should not be unraveling and that in some ways he feels that unraveling is a betrayal of the memory of his daughter. And so it makes it all the more acute and more painful, but also then all the more imperative for him to try to pull himself back together as a way of doing justice to, you know, he loses his only child, but he's still a parent.
And it doesn't stop his life.
Right, that's right. Almost does. Right. And I mean, and that's so this, yeah. You know, it's not really a spoiler alert to say that one of the big question, the fundamental question for him becomes, am I through almost attrition, almost through, you know, committing an attenuated kind of suicide by abusing drugs and alcohol and all this sort of stuff that comes up? Is that just a way of trying to sort of split the difference and still just commit suicide? As difficult as it is for him to try to get out of that cycle that he finds himself in, it becomes imperative for him to that's the difference between hope and hopelessness.
And again, like I said at the beginning of this, it's very, very dark, but there is that sense of hope that, you know, he's telling this story. So, you know, you're thinking,
right.
I'm hoping that, you know, when we get to the end, that he has found his way somewhere better.
Right. And the fact that it's first person and he's telling it in retrospect, and the fact that you trust Paul Harding not to pull the rug out from under you in any sort of
tricky –
there isn't
that three-card Monty.
There is no posthumous first-person narrative. He's alive. He's telling you the story. So somehow or another, he's come out on the other end of it. And as difficult as his story is and as modest, as it were, as the outcome is, it still is ultimately hopeful. And it's meant to be beautiful. And it's a book about love, you know. It's the threat of meaninglessness. It's the threat of total darkness. But just on the principle that, you know, the darkest hour is just before dawn. It's, you know, that just that idea of – as dark as things get, that just makes this, even if it's the smallest amount of light that comes into, you know, that illuminates at the end, it's all the more precious and all the more piercing and all the more beautiful for the fact that it resists total darkness.
Yeah, total annihilation.
Right, right.
It's just not an option.
Yeah. I mean, for me as an artist and aesthetically and spiritually and blah, blah, blah. It's just not – Flannery O'Connor, somebody says, you know, like novelists, you know, people without hope don't write novels. They don't make art. You know, so I think that's just a premise that I'm very open about.
What was it like being locked in with this story, though, for 2 years?
Oh, it's really intense. I mean, at first I thought, oh, goody, I've got a ghost story. I've got a New England ghost story on my hands. So it's Hawthorne and Poe and Emily Dickinson, and they're all certainly in there. But then I wrote the first paragraph of the book, and I realized this is a tragedy. This is just sort of this. I mean, there's no euphemistic way to get it. I'm writing a tragedy. And so I immediately just thought about, you know— every story takes part in a long tradition, and the, you know, this is Orpheus going down to the underworld. It's Persephone and Demeter. It's the parent going to the underworld and because he wants his daughter back, you know. So there's a long, rich history that I could rely on and think about. And also it was just a great way of actually disciplining the writing because I sort of feel like why bother trying to write a book if everything's not at stake? So the real danger that I had to work to avoid but was became one of the satisfactions of the book, of the composition of the book avoiding, was that if the basic premise of the novel is a parent losing his only child, you take one false step in any direction and you have maudlin, melodramatic, sentimental hogwash. And I just was that won't do. So it just became a way of just disciplining the writing to just stay with this character. It's written in first person, so to stay with this character as he experiences every single moment and not lapse into writing about things abstractly. So he grieves, but the book is not about grief. The book is about Charlie Crosby. It's about the protagonist. Because the moment you lapse into just writing about grief in a kind of theoretical or abstract or psychological way, you know, objective way, the value of it as a work of art, it's a very slippery slope.
I think it distances you from the actual thing you're trying to talk about.
Right, which is a human being. I'm trying to render a human soul. And every human soul must be granted its own experience of itself. So you can't come up with an idea of like what grief is per se and then spend the novel forcing the character to experience the predetermined definition you have of grief. You obliterate his humanity. You insult the reader. And, you know, you write a crummy novel, basically.
Right. Which is the last thing we want.
That's the last thing I want, too. Believe yes. me, we all want the same thing, you know, a good work of art.
In addition to being locked in your room with a very dark but hopeful story, mm-hmm. this also came after Tinkers,
yeah,
which we
right.
mentioned, which won you all kinds of very deserved accolades. Was there a pressure there for you to try to somehow repeat that?
There is, but it's a worldly pressure, and this is the sort of distinction you just have to make or you'll just be paralyzed, which is there's a predictable phenomenon that comes along with if you have a first book and the first book is very popular, people are going to be ready for the sophomore slump. There's going to be as many people who don't like the book because it's Tinkers 2 or don't like it because it's not Tinkers 2 or whatever. And as a writer, you just can't think about any of that. I was going to be – no matter – how well or poorly Tinkers did, I was going to be trying to write the best possible second novel I could. So when Tinkers won the Pulitzer and there was this big kind of worldly phenomenon around it, I just had to make sure that every day when I climbed down into the fictional world of Enon that all of that just went away, you know, didn't have any of that in my mind. And in that sense, I, you know, it was very, very helpful that I, you know, have a wonderful agent and a wonderful editor at Random House who just abetted me in writing the book that I wanted to write and just like help keep the sort of aesthetic integrity of, you know, like the sort of just the realm of the book of Enon separate from kind of all the other worldly stuff that was going on around it. So, I mean.
And you feel it was successful?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes as a private citizen when I was lying in bed at 4 a.m, I think, oh, my goodness, I've got to do this. You know, how am I going to do? But that's just – I mean, that's inevitable. But again, it's just then the minute, you know, you put your writing hat on, all that stuff just – because every ounce of energy or every brain cell that's distracted about what am I going to do, you know, following up that first novel or the second novel is something that's distracting you from what you should be rightly paying attention to, which is this guy, this book, his – what does he see right now? What does he feel right now? Where is he going? How does he feel? I mean, every single bit of your attention has to be devoted to the character at hand.
It's a wonderful book.
Oh, thank
you so
much.
It's so evocative, so beautiful, and so painful. It was so hard to go with him on that journey because you just kept – at least I kept feeling, oh, you know, I want – but then I knew he had to do what he had to do because otherwise, as you said, it would have been false.
Right.
If he had come out of it too soon, it would have felt like, oh, wait, that was too easy. You know,
oh, yeah, right, yeah.
You know? And I'm sure – or maybe not, but certainly as a reader, there were times where I thought, oh, just – you know, go there, but you know in real life that wouldn't happen.
Right. And then that's the deeper sense of, you know, I think a lot about John Keats and the formulation of truth is beauty and beauty is truth, which is that the book is finally beautiful and therefore generous and solicitous of the reader because its integrity comes from it staying true to its own subject and not pulling punches or not being euphemistic, not glossing over things so that as intense as this sort of journey with the protagonist might be, at the end you do feel joy and hope and you feel like you've just gone through a true experience, you know. My job as a writer is to blow your mind and to break your heart. And that's just by taking this human life seriously and by also basically saying yes to it, you know. Wallace Stevens, the poet, said that poetry is essentially saying yes to this world and our place in it. And that's what I feel like my job and my natural disposition is for every book that I write.
Paul Harding, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Harding's latest novel is called Enon. His previous book, Tinkers, won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Harding, who lives in Maine, was in Milwaukee this fall, and he spoke with Bonnie North then. You can hear Paul Harding read from Enon at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Friday's edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster, and the additional web support of Michelle Maternowski. I'm Mitch Teich. Bundle up and have a great weekend. Please join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.